All right, well, our second talk this morning is, am I on right here? Well, I'll just go here. Is How the Irish Elk Got Its Antlers, Phenotypic Plasticity and Objections to Evolution by Matthew Morris. Thank you, Matthew.
Great, thank you very much. If there's sort of one lesson I want you to take out of today, it's that as science educators teaching evolutionary biology, I think we need to not jump immediately into genetics, but begin with the phenotype and unpack some of the lessons that the phenotype has to share. And I'm going to talk about this in the context of an historical objection to evolution that involves this creature, the Irish elk. But I'll cover a couple things along the way. I want to frame this in the context of this paper from 2014 that suggests that there's a real problem in evolution education, and that 82% of high school students coming out of a biology class had misunderstandings about things such as natural selection, adaptation, fitness. And not only that, but 43% of the people teaching evolution had misunderstandings about some of these basic concepts in evolutionary biology. This is a little bit scary in that whether you teach evolution well or not, most of your students are going to misunderstand it anyways. In a world in which one in three Americans have serious opposition to evolutionary biology, but the majority of them don't understand evolutionary biology in the first place, right? This just sort of exacerbates issues. And I want to suggest that if we reframe some ways in which evolution is taught, we can overcome at least certain objections. I think if students are going to have objections to evolution, it should be based on sound science and not on misunderstandings of the science. And I want to bring up this particular historical argument from implausibility that involves this creature called the Irish elk. Not actually an elk, not actually from Ireland. There are some in Ireland, or were some in Ireland. It went extinct about 8,000 to 10,000 years ago. But this was an enormous creature that fossils were starting to be found in the 16 and 1700s. By the early 1800s, it was declared to be an extinct species. And it was renowned for the size of its antlers. We're talking about antlers that were 12 feet in length from tip to tip. This was a creature that was about 7 feet high at shoulder height. Its antlers weighed 88 pounds. And to naturalists in the 1800s, this led to a really interesting question. First, why were these antlers so large? And secondly, did the size of these antlers contribute to their extinction? How do you get a creature that can bear the weight of such enormous antlers? I mean, for contrast, there's a moose there, and we all know how enormous moose are. And this thing dwarfs even that. Now, what I'm showing you here is a histogram. If you're unfamiliar with histograms, this is really the frequency of elk size in a population. So at the peak of the graph, you're seeing the average antler size. And on the left and the right, we have extreme small and large antlers. And what it's showing here is that the small and the large are relatively rare in the population. So here's how the problem was presented in the mid-1800s. The problem was this. Right? If you're evolving larger antler sizes, you're going to have perhaps the largest antlered males are going to have the highest fitness. They're the ones that the females find quite attractive. So we have sexual selection going on here. So if the largest antlered males are reproducing, the next generation is going to have, on average, larger antlers. And now we're going to have a new extremely large antler size, a new combination of underlying mutations, although they weren't thinking about it in those terms back then. So again, you have this extreme selection, and you go on, and the antler size is getting larger and larger with each generation, but this leads to a real problem. The problem being, how do you support an 88-pound antler on your head? If the antlers are getting larger, you need a suite of other characteristics also evolving in order to support the size of those antlers. So you need not just large antlers evolving, at the same time, you also need those individuals with large antlers also having larger bodies. Also having skeletal support, also having the musculature to support those antlers, having blood supply to innervate those muscles, having nutrient supply to support the antlers. You need a whole variety of things fortuitously coming together in these individuals in order to support the larger antlers. So this led to an argument from implausibility. Evolution seemed implausible because of this coincidence of co-occurring features. They all had to be there at the same time in order to support the size of these antlers. Now, this was the objection in the 1800s. We see similar arguments from implausibility today, but today they take on not a phenotypic sort of objection, but a genetic objection. So this is a quote from Stephen Meyer's book, Darwin's Doubt. In it, he's quoting another biologist about a different phenotypic system. This is in a snake that has this really weird jaw. And what he argues is that in order for that weird jaw to evolve, you need the surrounding ligaments and tendons and all these things to support it, which seems implausible given that they all need to be under genetic control. So it's not just all these different phenotypes co-occurring, it's all these different mutations co-occurring simultaneously in order to produce this complexity. Now, what I'd like to suggest is that if we rediscover the phenotype in our evolution education, this argument from implausibility, the argument of fortuitous mutations, the argument of coincidental co-occurring complexities, this somewhat vanishes. If we understand a little more about the phenotype and its significance in evolution, it reduces this argument from implausibility. Now, to give a bit of historical context here, Wilhelm Johansson, or Johansson, did a series of experiments in the early 1900s on the phenotype, and he did it with beans. Now, in my class, I like to talk about these organisms that were sort of superheroes that transformed the world. Beans are kind of a boring example of this. But this set of experiments is actually really vitally important for where we are today in evolutionary biology. What Johansson did was he recognized that beans have their own phenotype. Phenotype in this case is an appearance, it could be a behavior, it's something about the organism, a trait or characteristic of the organism. And he looked at bean size. So we have a population of bean plants, each bean plant produces numerous beans. Those beans are all the result of separate fertilization events, so they're siblings or half-siblings. And when you look at a population of beans, you'll get an intermediate size, and you'll get rare small and rare large beans. What Johansson did was he took the smallest beans, and he bred plants that came from those small beans. So he excluded all the other beans. And what he ended up getting was a shift in the size of the beans that are developed by those plants. They ended up producing smaller beans. They ended up producing beans that were even smaller than what the initial population produced, and the largest bean sizes disappeared. When he took the largest beans, he gets the same thing, but in the opposite direction. This is evolution by artificial selection that he was doing in the early 1900s. Now, what he recognized was something really interesting was going on here. Because once the beans became highly inbred, when you did this selection experiment for long enough, evolution halted. Right? You select the smallest beans, and you do this for multiple generations, and then you've tapped out the genetic resources. Now, again, they weren't talking in that language at the time. But what he recognized is that you still get a distribution of phenotypic variation within the population. You take your inbred line, and you still have small beans and intermediate-sized beans and an average in the middle. But if you take the smallest beans and breed them, the next generation is identical to the generation that came before. If you take the largest beans and just breed them, the population is identical to what came before. You've stopped evolution by artificial selection. So he recognized there must be a difference between phenotype and genotype. The underlying stuff of evolution is different than the stuff causing the phenotype. And he came to a number of conclusions from this. He concluded that phenotypic variation in a population is due in part to genetic variation. Individuals look different because they have different mutations, and due to differences in environmental input. Even on the same plant, beans exhibit differences in size because they're experiencing different microenvironmental characteristics. And what's really fascinating is that you can't tell the difference. You can look at phenotypic variation and you cannot a priori tell the difference between variation induced by the environment and variation induced by mutation. The environment can mimic mutational phenotypic variation. But what he also recognized is that environmentally induced phenotypes must be irrelevant to evolution because this stuff didn't allow for further evolutionary change. This is environmentally induced variation. You select that and it doesn't get passed on to the next generation. Okay, so for decades, researchers were obsessed with common garden experiments, because common garden experiments reduce that embarrassing environmental variation that's irrelevant to evolution and maintains the important genetic stuff. But then this superhero came around on the scene. Superman has a variety of phenotypes, all these remarkable superpowers, right? But if you know anything about Superman's history, especially in the early comics, this is what he's like on Earth, but this is what he's like on Krypton. He's just another face in the crowd, and you can plot Superman's phenotype from one environment to another. We call this a reaction norm, this line that connects the phenotypic capacities of a single organism. So on Earth, under Earth's low gravity conditions and our yellow wavelengths light from the sun, he can fly. But on Krypton, with high gravity and red light, he cannot fly. Single individual, single genotype, variety of possible phenotypic expressions. This is sort of cartoon representation of phenotypic plasticity, or the capacity of a single genotype to produce different phenotypes in different environmental contexts. It turns out there are real-life superheroes, or supermen, among us. And as these supermen were discovered, questions started to arise about whether these environmentally induced phenotypes might actually have evolutionary significance. Might plasticity be important from an evolutionary perspective? And one of the early lessons that came from these initial studies, pioneered by James Mark Baldwin and C.H. Waddington and some others, but really popularized in the 80s and 90s, 1980s and 1990s, is that plastic changes, environmentally induced changes, can be adaptive. What you're looking at here is a water flea. These are clones of one another, so they are genetically identical and yet phenotypically extremely different. And the difference here is the environment in which they were raised. The one on the right has body armor because it was raised in the presence of predators. The one on the left lacks that body armor. No mutation here, but clearly adaptive. Normally we talk about adaptation as a process that involves mutation, but these are genetically identical, clearly adaptive changes. What's really fascinating, now with the water fleas, they've gone through many generations of selection on plasticity itself, and I'll talk about that in a moment. But what's really fascinating is when you have environmentally induced changes in phenotype that have absolutely no evolutionary history behind them, there's just an inherent capacity to change within the organism. What you're looking at on the left is a species of moss. This comes from NASA. On the right is the same species of moss, but it's grown in low gravity conditions on the International Space Station. So all the gravity sensing cells aren't sensing gravity, and it completely alters how the moss develops into this weird spiral morphology never before seen in the species, or as far as I know, any species of moss, because there are no moss living in these sorts of conditions. But when you change the environment to something new, it can produce dramatic phenotypic change within a generation. Not slow, gradual changes that are occurring across long periods of time. And I'm not saying these things are in contrast to one another. This is just another wrinkle in our evolutionary story. What's also become clear is that individuals can vary in plasticity. So there is genetic variation in the capacity for organisms to change. And when you have genetic variation, then this capacity itself can evolve. Now, what I study are three-spined stickleback, which is this fish species here, and they're pretty interesting because they can be found in marine and freshwater environments. And if you take marine stickleback, which are the ancestors of the freshwater form, you take them and raise them in salt water, you'll get very little phenotypic variation in size. You'll get fair consistency, but raise that same population in freshwater, and it expresses all sorts of differences in body size. This is in part because all of these stickleback, in fact, have mutations that are being suppressed by things like heat shock proteins. But when you stress them out, that capacity to withstand those mutations is no longer able to hold. So that capacity falls away and all these mutations are suddenly expressed. Now in freshwater stickleback, the highest fitness seems to be for smaller body size. And so what you end up having is natural selection weeding out the individuals that were plastic in the wrong direction and favoring the individuals that were plastic in the right direction. So now you have small body stickleback, move them back into the ocean, and they will look indistinguishable from the marine ancestors. So plasticity, this capacity to change, is itself genetically based and can evolve. What's really cool is that it's been implicated in speciation. This is another stickleback example, just because I can't speak enough about stickleback. In Canada, in British Columbia, we have these lakes where there are two different forms of freshwater stickleback co-occurring, a benthic and a limnetic form. They're ecologically isolated. They're also reproductively isolated, in part through behavioral mechanisms. The limnetic form is the small guys, they're open water plankton feeders. The benthic form feed on larger macroinvertebrates in the bottom of the lake. Again, they evolved from marine stickleback, and what researchers have found recently is that you can take marine stickleback, feed them a limnetic diet, And that diet induces morphological changes in the direction of the limnetic stickleback species type. Feed them a benthic diet and induces morphological changes in the direction of the benthic stickleback diet. So without needing genetic variation, you're getting halfway to the benthic and limnetic species morphologies. So they call this the flexible ancestor. A plastic organism has the capacity to go in two different directions phenotypically. And if it goes in one direction in one population and another direction in another population, it now looks completely different, and then underlying genetics can lock that in place so it loses its plasticity. And now they, for all intents and purposes, can become reproductively isolated. And the fifth, there's many lessons here, but there's just too much to talk about in 20 minutes. So the last one I want to mention here, before I get back to the Irish elk, is how phenotypic plasticity can accommodate what should otherwise be deleterious mutations of large effect. On the left is a two-legged goat. This goat had a mutation that should have destroyed it. The lack of front legs, right, should be pretty deleterious. But it was behaviorally plastic. It learned to hop on its hind limbs. Back in 1942, there was a series of papers that came out on a similar two-legged goat. What you're looking at on A and B, A is a typical goat, B is the two-legged goat that's learned how to hop. And by learning how to hop, it induces all sorts of changes in the skeletal structure that have nothing to do with the two-legged mutation. These are compensations for the two-legged mutation, where if you look at the right-hand side, you have a longer gluteal tongue, and you have new tendons that aren't found in a typical goat to help support this musculature. And down here, there's an ischium that looks a lot like what you find in kangaroos. So within a single individual, by learning to hop, there were morphological changes that were induced that are akin to other hopping organisms. You don't need mutation for this. It occurs due to the inherent capacity of organisms to change. This is living tissues responding to stressors. So plasticity has this really strange relationship with evolutionary biology. Your typical textbook evolution, and I'm going to say that this is still Darwinian evolution. There's nothing sort of new here, just a weird wrinkle. And the way we typically teach evolution, the phenotype that matters is genetically determined. But under phenotypic plasticity, the phenotype that matters is environmentally induced. Under textbook evolution, evolution's occurring very slowly across generations. But with phenotypic plasticity, it's immediate, or relatively immediate. It's within a single generation. The size of the change under textbook evolution is typically fairly small, right? Small, slow, gradual. But with phenotypic plasticity, it can be quite large. You go from a moss that looks like a moss to this weird spiral thing within a single individual, without slow transitional steps along the way. And the scope of the change is typically, under textbook evolution, it slowly spreads. You have a mutation that slowly spreads through the population, so the average characteristics change gradually. Whereas with phenotypic plasticity, if you have a large environmental change that affects all individuals plastically respond at once. If you take water fleas and throw them into predators, and they have this capacity to develop armor, all of them will develop armor immediately. Or, well, within that generation. Or else they'll get eaten, that's exactly right. So to come back to plasticity and the plausibility of evolution, I just have three very brief points that I want to raise. And the first, this is maybe more of an aside, but it's that student intuitions are not always misconceptions. That paper that I began with that said 43% of instructors and 82% of students misunderstand evolution, one of the key questions was how they responded to this statement that individual organisms adapt to their environments. If the student said yes, individual organisms adapt to their environments, they were labeled as misunderstanding evolution. But under phenotypic plasticity, of course individuals adapt to their conditions. If you have this capacity to change, you can absolutely change your phenotype in an adaptive direction. It's not always adaptive, sometimes it's maladaptive, sometimes it's neutral, but there is the possibility of adaptive phenotypic change occurring within an individual. So there's absolutely nothing wrong with this statement. And so I think we should work from student intuitions. Start with the phenotype and bring students along with the sense of individual adaptation to talk about plasticity and the phenotype and its significance before getting into sort of the nuts and bolts of your textbook evolution. So they get to this Irish elk, and this argument that there are simply too many coincidences, these giant antlers supporting, or how could you support 88 pounds on your head without all these other things happening? Well, August Wiseman in the 1890s proposed a plasticity answer to this dilemma. Even though we're still bringing this dilemma up today, it was, I think, solved in 1894. He expresses the problem as this. He says, let us take the well-known instance of the gradual increase in development of the deer's antlers. It is actually technically a deer, not an elk. In consequence of which, the head in the course of generations has become more and more heavily loaded. The question has been asked as to how it is possible for the parts of the body which have to support and move this weight to vary simultaneously and harmoniously if the changes have resulted from processes of selection only. It just seems implausible that selection could cause an organism that is able to support this these giant antlers. So his solution, this is from the Remains lecture in 1894, is that it's by no means necessary that all the parts concerned, skull, muscles, ligaments, vertebrae, bones, should simultaneously adapt themselves by variation of the germ. Okay, this is the guy who came up with germ and somatic cell differentiation. So in other words, it's not mutation. For in each separate individual, the necessary adaptation will be temporarily accomplished by the struggle of parts under the influence of functional stimulus. In other words, organisms have a capacity to change. Cells are competing with each other. There are stressors that go on, and you can have large antlers, and that can exist because of the underlying phenotypes compensating for that mutation of large effect. So if you were to summarize this argument, elk with small antlers have lower fitness. In the next generation, you have a mutation that produces larger antlers. This should be devastating to the organism if the body can't compensate for it. But what Wiseman recognized is that if you have a small body that's caused in part by response to developmental stimuli, you have a small body because you have small antlers. And if you have a mutation, that mutation produces a new developmental environment for all the other cells in that body that they can now plastically respond to. Produces new stresses that leads to a larger body caused by this response to developmental stimuli. In other words, the elk could always have been larger or smaller. It's dependent on the size of the antlers, how the antlers are growing, which produces the environment in which the body plastically responds. And what's important here is you recognize this isn't Lamarckian at all. The capacity for larger or smaller bodies is what's passed down, not the modifications themselves. So the same elk that is large would have been small had its antlers been small. The elk that's small would have been large had its antlers been large. It's the capacity that's inherited, not the modified phenotypes themselves. Now, that's all sort of hypothetical, but we can see what's going on today in other systems. This is the final little point I want to raise, is that Wiseman's argument has been substantiated in numerous systems, including this really cool fish that is semi-terrestrial. And what these researchers did in 2014 was raise this semi-terrestrial fish in a nearly terrestrial environment. Normally this thing fishes the majority, or swims the majority of the day, comes out on land to hunt at night, so it's only walking a little bit. They raised it in an environment where it had no choice but to walk all the time. And by walking all the time, it improved its ability to walk, and it improved its ability to walk by altering its musculature and its skeletal system in a way that looks a lot like what we see in the fossil record in the transition from life in the water to life on land. In other words, we see in a single individual large phenotypic changes occurring that we've been hunting desperately for transitional forms for in the fossil record forever, and they may not exist because they may have been induced through plastic changes rather than mutational changes. So environmentally induced phenotypic change is evolutionarily significant, and I think it's important for us as educators to be aware of this because it lines up with student intuition. It helps reduce objections based on implausibility of too many phenotypes and mutations occurring simultaneously to form complex phenotypes. And it means that we don't need transitional forms, or we never expect to find transitional forms for certain phenotypes in the fossil record, because these are large-scale changes occurring at once. Oops. So thank you very much. Here's some additional reading if you're at all interested. I'll take any questions if we have time.
That's really interesting. I wonder that for a creature like the Irish elk of relatively recent antiquity, you could, what you say sounds are the antlers the only thing modifiable? Are there proteins that pertain to the skeletal system, or the musculature system, right, that also mutated? Right? You can put that in the genetic test.
Right, well,
whether it's just...
Sort of true. And you can get ancient DNA. The problem is it's not actually either or. I didn't have time to talk about all of this. But if you look up the Baldwin effect, it suggests that you can have genetic changes that occur after the fact. So plasticity comes first, and then genetic changes can. So let's say you have an organism. It's plastic. It expresses this one phenotype, and the environment is always that way. So it never has a chance to express the old phenotype again. You can then have mutations coming in play that enhance these modifications, improve these modifications, or even lock these modifications into place. So identifying mutations wouldn't actually be a good test of this. A better test is to have living organisms and induce novel environments in those organisms and see how they phenotypically respond. There are some really cool papers that look at the Baldwin effect in birds. There are some birds that learn their song, and there are other birds that are born with their song. And under the Baldwin effect, it would suggest that the birds that learn their song, that sort of came first, and the birds that just know, they have an intuition for their song or an instinct, that those were genetic modifications that locked that song into place after they had the inherent capacity to learn.
So living organisms don't actually solve the genetic modifications? You had enough time to observe?
No, what you can observe is the phenotypic change. So with this particular fish, that simply by walking, it induces changes that look a lot like what we see in the transition from life in water to life on land, and that's without mutation at all. So it's highly suggestive. I would recommend, because there's just so much to talk about here, and it's a really cool topic, Mary Jane West Eberhard's 2003 book, Developmental Plasticity and Evolution. It's long, but it is outstanding. And we'll give you lots of fodder, I think, for further discussion.
I could probably ask anyway.
We can get on recording this way.
That was going to be sort of my question also, that the capacity to make those changes must already be there. But does this address the idea of punctuated equilibrium, that you might see a significant change, and it was simply a plastic reaction that eventually became fixed?
Yeah, so punctuated equilibrium, from the very little that I know about it, still is occurring over fairly large geologic timescales, whereas these plastic changes are occurring within a single generation. But it's possible you could see abrupt transitions in the fossil record because of something like plasticity.
Good, let me ask maybe add a question here.
Yeah.
So it sounds like this relates a lot to the sort of developmental capacities here. Has some of that been unlocked, some of those developmental mechanisms been unlocked in terms of phenotypic plasticity?
Yeah, so I mean, this is really Evo-Devo that I'm talking about, clearly. Plasticity is really difficult because there's so many different flavors of it. So the example that I provided with the Daphne, this is actually a very complex phenotype, producing body armor or not. It's not like they can just produce body armor. There's a lot of selection that occurred, which happens when you're moving back and forth between environments constantly. Plasticity itself can evolve. And we know a lot about the underlying development. You have these receptors that latch onto chiromones that are being released by predators. It induces certain genetic changes that stimulate certain cells that are pluripotent that become body armor cells. And if you don't have that stimulation, then you don't produce that body armor. But then things like the moss, this is simply a sort of a byproduct of having gravity sensing cells. And if they can't sense the gravity, they can't do their job. With things like blind cavefish, we now know that heat shock proteins suppress genetic variation in the development of eyes. So you have a protein that has a mutation. That mutation should knock that protein out, but heat shock proteins come in and refold the protein so the eye can develop properly. Put them in the dark and the heat shock proteins get completely stressed. That capacity disappears and the eyes become much smaller. Doesn't get you blind, but it gets you much closer to being blind. So all sorts of, again, it's not like they had that capacity because of past evolutionary selection for smaller eyes. It's a capacity that the fish didn't know it had. It just suddenly expressed under these stressful conditions. So there's all sorts of flavors that plasticity can take. There are butterflies that express a novel blue color under warmer temperatures, and as temperatures rise, this new color is being expressed. Certain wing patterns can be induced by temperature as well, that we see mirrored in different species that have those patterns locked in place, but species that haven't gone through that process are now exposing this inherent capacity for the first time. All sorts of weird stuff, but it's pretty cool.
Thank you, Matthew.
Thank you.